and therefore you don't want to be there. And then, after that, you come to a level of love, which is after you experience Torah mitzvos, for whatever motivation you first did them, so then, afterwards, you begin to love Hashem, and love Torah, and love the mitzvos. From that point, it goes from that love to a higher level of fear, but this level of fear is not actually fear, but awe. In other words, there's a kind of two types of fear. There's yiras ha'onesh, which is fear of punishment, and there's what we call yiras ha'romimus. What? I have no more money. Yiras ha'romimus, which is fear, which is awe. So since they're two different types, so therefore one precedes love and the other follows love. Because once you love Hashem, then you continue to be in awe of Hashem. In fact, the Rambam says the way you come to love Hashem is by looking at all His wonders, what great things He did. And that's how you come to love Him. And that is that obviously if you come to love Him through that, you also come to have awe of Him as well. Kiderech Eretz Kod Malachim. And the way the Tzaddik links this concept of the Chilu Rechimu to Derech Eretz, which comes before Torah. In other words, a person is supposed to have proper respect before he can learn Torah. The proper respect is Derech Eretz. The Torah is what causes the love of Hashem. It's interesting to note that Reb Chaim Vital actually asked the question. Reb Chaim Vital was one of the students of the Arizal. So we asked the question, why the Torah never speaks about midos. It never says don't get angry. It never says be patient. It never says that be frugal. Whatever all the traits which Benjamin Franklin has advises people to adopt. So why doesn't the Torah speak about that? The good is obviously we hold a person supposed to have good midos. So Reb Chaim Vital's answer. There are other answers. Reb Chaim Vital's answer is that, like we see here, Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah. In other words, you can't learn Torah unless Derech Eretz precedes it. So by definition, in order for your Torah to be legitimate, there has to be a preceding work, or preceding shaping of your Derech Eretz that it should be proper. Okay? There is, obviously, after that, the Ramban says, and Rambam both say, that mitzvahs themselves were given to make human beings more refined. So that really is, there has to be a certain element of Derech Eretz before the Torah. Then the Torah itself leads you to that higher level of refinement.
Is it that you can't learn Torah before you have Derech Eretz, or you won't be able to?
You won't be able to learn Torah the right way. In other words, you're building on top of quicksand. It won't be sustained. It will not have the proper effect. It says that the people were anti-Mutter in the 19th century said that Torah changes a person's midos traits in and of itself. But clearly it has been demonstrated time and again that only if somebody has some devotion to actually want to change their midos. Otherwise, you have no foundation. So, yeah, you can learn Torah without their cheret, but the Torah is not going to have the desired effect. And afterwards also, the Torah then helps the process. It helps the process along. So it's also somewhat like the Dechilu, first the Derech Eretz, then the Rechimu, the love of Hashem, which has to do with learning Torah, and afterwards again, the Dechilu, a fear or an awe, which obviously makes you a more refined, better functioning human being. Okay?
Why don't they teach Derech Eretz in yeshivas?
There actually was a program which Talmud Torah promoted a few years ago, they do teach Derech Eretz in yeshivas. My kids had it when they were in Chicago. It failed dismally. I don't know exactly what. I don't think the curriculum wasn't particularly inspired. So that's why it probably didn't take off. But,
what do you mean Derech Eretz? Like, you help your friends out, don't yell at someone, like that type of stuff?
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, yeah. Come on, you push in front of the other guy and knock him over.
Right.
And get to something.
Happens with the white teacher a lot.
Mutually.
You hear what they say to each other. Just
so, look, in all fairness to the yeshiva system, they don't teach Derech Eretz in the public school system either.
No.
So I don't think that we're... That's not a justification.
But
you're right, it's not a justification.
There's probably more Derech Eretz though, that I've seen. going through public school.
Well, they say I've never been to public school, so I don't know. But they say in public school there's much more derech eretz for the teachers than there is in yeshivas.
Right, like for instance, because the teachers actually have power to do something to the kids, because the parents don't care, and the parents aren't, you know, like the parents. Most of the parents in public school could care less. So what happens is that if the kid wants to graduate, you know, then if a kid like yells at another kid and says something, the teacher will be like, "All right, get out of my class," and then he misses school, which like is a big deal, and then he gets bad grades and then he can't go to college,
mm-hmm.
which is his entire life.
Uh-huh.
So like they have more, I think, ability to discipline than the yeshiva teachers I've seen. There's not much a yeshiva teacher can do. I'm going to fail you. I can't fail him. He has to get a degree from high school in order to get a job. Otherwise, you just, you know, otherwise he's not going to, there's too much compassion. It's like, I can't fail the kid because if I fail the kid, he won't get a job and then he won't be able to support a family. In public school, they don't care about the kids. So they say, you didn't do it. All right, fail him. We don't care if he has to live on welfare. So.
Also, public school is a private school. In public school, you tend to be there. Even for non-religious private schools, the parents demand straight A's for every single student.
Right. But in public school, the parents aren't paying for it, so they're not so quick to sue.
Okay, so I don't have a good answer for you. That's bottom line. Yeshivas no longer. Yeshivas in general. No longer teach Musa. There's no Musa, people go out and schmooze, depending on their inclinations, but there is no concerted effort in yeshivas to work and help kids work on their midos.
Was there?
All shmuzim, yeah.
They have slanker like there was.
Yeah.
Right?
Almost all the speeches given in yeshivas today are learn Torah, learn more Torah, and more Torah. Right? And they never learn.
The kids in my class, they all had to learn half an hour a day, and they got to go camping if they learned half an hour a day or Venus Manim. And there were some kids who couldn't do it, couldn't cut it.
Couldn't really, huh?
They couldn't cut half an hour a day.
but I don't know, in Orthomech, do you guys get lectures on Vidos?
Every night there used to be one.
Right. Oh, so that's half a year. Right. That's right. What happened to it?
They vanished because there weren't enough people going.
Even here, the most idealistic institution on the planet.
Beginner program has it all day. Like Rabbi Reichshir and like all the beginning shears always sneak it in.
Until you get Judaism, then you don't need it anymore.
Until you can learn. As soon as you can read the Gemara, then you don't need it anymore. Then you just learn
it. It's hard.
Yeah, of course it's hard. That Rabbi Solzman is supposed to have said that it's easier to learn all of Shas than it is to change one Mida. And I can tell you it's true. I have learned Shas a couple of times, and Yerushalmi, and I still haven't changed any of my Midas. So it is very hard. So that's in fact the case. It's kind of sad, but...
So the solution is send everyone to Orsamach and make sure they don't learn enough Gemara to move up in the shir.
Right. Yeah, so basically the Musa Yeshiva died in World War II. It's whatever happened after World War II. There was a few stragglers still left, but...
My yeshiva
was in Musa. Which yeshiva left?
Mir.
Which Mir?
Brooklyn.
I went to Mir in Brooklyn too. I don't know, maybe you went considerably before me, I guess, because in 1984, there wasn't much Musa going on in Mir either. Yeah, so you had the Rabbi Feldman, right? Who was the Mashgiach?
Feldman.
So maybe he and then, when I got there, he wasn't alive anymore. So I don't know. But in 84, there was no Musa in the Mir. I mean, you know, yeah, Musa's there. I don't remember what I did during the Mir. It certainly was not a concerted... It wasn't even a Mashgiach when I was there, so really, it certainly wasn't like that. And Rishon Birnbaum was smoothing all about, you know, learning more and more Torah, that's all. Okay, so See, a lot of it, I think, to be fair, a lot of it is the fault of people like me, because I like learning this kind of chassidus, which actually has a very little mussar in it, because it's much more fun. So that's why, you know, mussar falls by the wayside, because we have more exciting things to learn. Yes. Do you think anybody in this room would say jar the earrings?
I would.
What about their Midos Tovos? They're very good people.
Come
on, just move your own ears.
Come on.
Okay, well, I'll watch them. Yes. Okay, so. Volam Nivra of the base. The world is was created with a base. Shuhu Ayira. Interesting point, he said, that the base is considered to be Yira. Wow, so. Fear. Shua Timtum, because that indicates God constricting himself. God hiding himself. How so? Kilim Shnayim Bore Venivra. The Timtum was when God concealed his presence, so there could be two separate entities, the creator and the created. So that's the entire relationship of Yira is predicated on a separation. Ava, the way Rav Putnam explains it very beautifully in one of his poems, is that Ava is to expand towards something. Yira is to contract or retreat away from something. So when Hashem created the world, it was an act of Yira. The act of Yira was the retreat. As Arizal's Marshal has it, there was a vacant space in which the world came to be. Now, the vacant space is not literal, but figuratively speaking, Hashem's presence is concealed. So Hashem says concealed, that leads to Yira, because there is a separation, a distance, a gap. Were the world to be in a perfected state, there would be no Yira anymore, because then there would be Dveikus, a connection between Hashem and the Jewish people, Hashem and humanity, if you please, and there would then be a state of Ava as opposed to a state of Yira.
There'd be no world anymore, though.
No, not necessarily. That's the point of Olam Haba. The point of Olam Haba is somehow that there's a way in which, depending on whether it's spiritual according to the Rambam or physical according to the Ramban, that there can be some unity between the physical and the divine, and yet they do not have to blend with each other. They don't have to merge back into, you know, all pervading Hashem. That's what the Ramchal says. The Ramchal says the ultimate chiddush, the ultimate novelty in the world being created is this concept that the physical and the spiritual, or in essence Hashem and the multiple creations which he made, can be united and bonded, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they both cease to exist. That one ceases to exist.
In Ari Kaplan's book, The Life On, where he quotes like different Hasidic sources, I think one of them was saying that the world would cease to exist if there wasn't constriction of Hashem. And then that constriction allows the illusion of reality, so to speak. Because really, Hashem fills the whole world anyway. So on a certain level, everything's Hashem anyway. But on a more hidden level, there's a constriction. But if that constriction were united again, then there would be no world.
Yeah, it can't be fully right. It can't be fully united in the sense that then everything would return to, in fact, be one of the more unity of Hashem altogether. But the unification, that's why the Kabbalistic chants and rituals are called Yichudim, because they unify. Yichud means to unify. They unify the world below with the world above. And that's why all the metaphors in Kabbalah about Hashem and Klal Yisrael is that Hashem is the husband and Klal Yisrael is the bride, the wife. And I'm sure you're aware that Kabbalah sometimes becomes quite graphic in terms of its description of that relationship, which is why we had sects like Shabtai Tzvi and Jacob Frank and other, and I guess the Kabbalah Center nowadays, which take the metaphor literally and do all sorts of things on that basis.
Really?
Yes. I know the Kabbalah said, I shouldn't say that. Now I don't know what they do there. Shabtai Tzvi, they're very into sexual practices.
With their wives or what?
And others. They used to do the same as it doesn't go on anymore, but they used to have one night a year when they used to have a wife swapping ceremony.
How did they permit this? Just because of Kabbalah? As long as you had the right Kavanah, right?
Yeah. I don't know exactly how this is. No, so Shabbos came and gave a new Torah. And there was also the Frankus also was supposed to have been worse.
What's Frankus?
The Frankus, there was a guy in the early 1700s, his name was Jacob Frank, who also was a Sabbatean. He also believed he was Mashiach. And he instead converted to Islam, converted to Christianity, but he also had very licentious practices, you know, as part and parcel of his own. So, you know, so that relationship is the paradigm, because that's eventually the connection which is supposed to be forged, and that's why the Kabbalah is full of that symbolism, and that's why one of the reasons they say one shouldn't learn Kabbalah before one is 40, even though people don't keep that nowadays. Because you have to, because of the metaphors, it can arouse passions. So therefore, a person's not supposed to do that, be involved until his passions have somewhat diminished. And so here he says, so the world was created with Beis in order, Bereishis, in order to indicate that there are two, Borei v'Nivra. When we chil and Nivra olam b'midas adin, mem Beis, that Rosh Tevos, the Beis mem dalet hey dalet, that's b'midas adin. With the attribute of judgment. V'acharkach, and then afterwards, Shitei Midas Harachamim, God partnered the Midas Adin with the Midas Harachamim, the attribute of justice with the attribute of mercy. Now, this makes sense according to what we just said. The sense of first there is the separation, and then there is the combining again. And that's the Arizal's metaphor. He's into the vacant black space. Hashem emanated light. It wasn't an all-pervading light, because then obviously the vacant space would cease to exist. But it illuminated the darkness. And that's the idea of first Midas Adin, the stepping back, and then Midas Harachamim, which is the connection again. The shame which we always associate, the name of God we associate with Midas Harachamim, is Yudkei Vavkei. That name has nothing inherently to do with Rachamim. It doesn't say anything in that name about Rachamim. We know, totally simplistically, that represents God was, is, will be, and sustains everything. What does that do with Rachamim? But the idea, the assumption is that whenever God reveals how, by some miraculous means, or in the Beis HaMikdash, how he was, is, will be, and sustains everything, that by definition is a Midas HaRachamim. Because the revelation is, by definition, good, with one exception. And I have many exceptions, but one exception to the rule is when people are so evil that Hashem's revelation compels destruction. Oh. That's what happened by Stone, according to the Bali Machshava, the Hasidim and such like, that Hashem revealed himself as Stone. And since there was such a jarring contrast between Stone and God's revelation, there wasn't room for both of them. And one of them had to cease to exist. The one which ceased to exist was Sodom. So that was how Sodom was destroyed. And it says, the way Chazal put it, that Rishoyim mahatchim midas harachmim v'midas hadin. Rishoyim, evil people, turn the trait of mercy into the trait of judgment. While tzaddikim turned the midas hadin into midas harachmim, they changed the judgment into mercy. Because rishoyim, when confronted with God, there's a dissonance, and therefore there's a pulling back, and there's destruction. Whereas tzaddikim, even to traverse the gap created by midas hadin, by the separation, and thus turn it into a vehicle by which they bring about unity, which is midas harachmim. Okay, so. Lachain Seder, Derech Eretz, it's interesting, you know, what the Torah says here is indicates to me that I probably made a mistake before. Not probably, yes, I'm pretty sure I made a mistake. Certainly made a mistake. When he says Derech Eretz, Kodam Torah before, I explained that Derech Eretz is the Yira and Torah is the Ava. No, it's not what he means. What he means is, even before you get to Torah, you need to have Derech Eretz. And Derech Eretz is the proper proportion of the midos of Yira and Ahava. In other words, you have Yira and Ahava before you learn Torah. You have to have the proper relationship with Hashem prior to learning Torah. And he says that both the Yira and the Ahava, both the Dechilu, the fear, and the Rechimu, the love, are Seder Derech Eretz. That's how a person conducts himself even before he reaches the stage of actual Torah.
How can you forge a proper relationship with God before learning any Torah? Because you don't know what that is. I mean, Torah tells us what the relationship should be. Just by singing and dancing?
No. The Pirkei Avos...
Was your Hillel for a while before becoming...
It sounded like an anti-Hasidic swipe there. But the Pirkei Avos said, Ein bur yireches, below am aras kusim. A bur, which happens to be the same word in English, a coarse, boorish person, is not fearful of sin. And an am aras, an ignorant person, cannot be a chosid. Can't be a chosid, which is a very high level, far much higher than fearful of sin. So, I think it's from Ben Yonah, one of the Parshman Avos said, but from this we see that am aras can be a reches. Even a person who's an am aras has a capacity to have fear of sin, which is quite high level. So our assumption is that there's a certain inherent holiness in a Jew, which is brought out even by rudimentary, mitzvot and the like, which is then enables that person to build on that. You build up a yiran ava, a awe and love, which precedes the Torah. There's a famous Gemara, the Yerushalmi book, and I've placed it several times in the Bavli, which says that even though normally you can't trust an amara, to say that he took the proper mice, the proper tithe off his produce. On Shabbos, you can trust him. Because the Gemara says, Eimas Shabbos al Am Oret. The fear of Shabbos is on the Am Oret. Even an ignorant Jew is so afraid of Shabbos, this is good old days, right? Mm-hmm. Even an ignorant Jew is so afraid of Shabbos, he won't lie on Shabbos. So there, obviously, we're talking about, the Am Oret. Even the Am Oretim at one point, it had this capacity to have proper Derech Eretz, even though they didn't have Torah. Sure. And I think that also has to do with, even though he's not necessarily addressing children here, but certainly by children, that infused, ideally speaking, with some sense of Derech Eretz prior to actually being immersed in Torah. Right? Derech Eretz before Torah? Okay, so Zel Kodem Lazarek, because here you see explicitly I was wrong before. Zel Kodem Lazarek, that's before the Torah. Shehu Torah Chesed. Now, Torah, he says, that's certainly Torah Chesed. Torah is called Torah Chesed. Torah is called Torah Chesed for several reasons. Primarily because when I learn Torah, I do a chesed with the world. This is, thank you for sharing. This is, when I do a chesed with the world because it brings more kedusha to the world that I learn Torah, and if I do it, of course, with that intent, I'm actually benefiting the world. If I do it just to benefit myself, it's egotistical and it's not as meaningful, that's not Torah chesed, that's not lishma, that's not doing it for the right reason. But if you do it for the benefit of mankind, then it actually benefits mankind. Also, a person is supposed to not just learn for themselves, a person is also supposed to be able to teach and share with others. That's also part of Torah Chesed. But what Reb Tzadok is saying here is Torah Chesed means that it is it's a Chesed relationship between Hashem and myself. What's the Chesed relationship? Chesed is a relationship which extends. I extend myself towards others. So too, with Torah, there is a chesed relationship in that Hashem draws close to us, and we can draw close to Hashem. So that's how he's only chesed in a more abstract sense, not so much literal sense, but a more abstract sense. Uposachas be'alus. And the Torah itself opens with alus. Which Torah are we talking about?
Tomorrow?
No.
Krishna.
With what?
Opens with an alus. This is tricky.
Zohar? Mishnah.
Somewhere in the Tanakh.
Somewhere in Tanakh, yeah.
Devarim? Yeshua?
Yes.
Psalms?
What famous part of Torah opens with an Aleph?
Ten Commandments?
How does it open?
Anochi Hashem
Elokecha. The Ten Commandments begin, the giving of the Torah begins with an Aleph. That's where the Torah be. Of course, we all gracious is Torah, but actually the Torah began to be given formally only at Mahar Sinai. And whatever is in braces, maybe they had some records before, but only became Torah after Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai, this is part of Torah. So Anochi, Hashem Elokecha, is actually the first actual Torah which they saw God. And that starts with an Aleph. And that's why this, and it's fact that entire mitzvah of Anochi, Hashem Elokecha, is the mitzvah of Emunah. The mitzvah of belief in God and our special relationship with Hashem. Special relationship which comes from Yetzias Mitzrayim, from the fact he took us out of Egypt with a great love. And the Bosachas Ba'alit Shu'ava Udvekus, which is love, you know, Echad, Gematria is Ava, right? You all know that? Echad and Echad is how much?
Love?
No, Gematria.
Gematria?
13.
And Ava is?
13.
Does anybody here realize that before?
No.
Okay, no. Now, so let's play this game a little bit further. What's the Yudke Vavke?
The 26. No. Yeah.
What is it?
26.
26, right. 26 is 2 times 13, right? So the Yudke Vavke's Chiddush is that those things that the two halves are one, meaning that those things which are below and those things which are above are really connected together. So that, I think, is why there's the multiple of 13, 26. Then you can take it further, and I never have, but 13, 26, 39. What's 39?
Melachos
of Shabbos. Melachos
of Shabbos.
So you have, and this continues on, actually. The 52 is one of the names of God in Kabbalah.
52 weeks
in a year. I mean, think of that one, very good. So there are all sorts of associations which are made with base 13. What comes after 52?
63.
65, right?
No,
65.
65.
There's some sort of 65. What is it?
Chemical element.
What? 65
is... I don't know,
65. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not sure how far we can take this, but maybe there is... But certainly 13, 26, 39, there's something sequential there, and 52 also. So obviously there's some connection with all those things, and if you had time, you could spend a lot of time contemplating that. Okay, but in any event, Aleph represents Avon Bekus because of the association of oneness and unity. Kilu HaKol Echon, as if everything has become one. Shemagia LaTorah, Ava Kodemes. And when a person reaches Torah, that's when love comes first. So the way the Tzaddik has it arranged, so you have Yira first, then Ava, then Torah, then Ava, then Yira. Okay, so in essence, there's the Derech Eretz prior to Torah is first Yira, and then Ava, and then that's the prelude to Torah, which is actually a Torah of love, of connection. Then you come to greater love, which then leads you to greater awe. Because the more you know Hashem, the more you are in awe of Him.
So if someone skips ahead, let's say someone has feelings of awe for Hashem and grandeur of Hashem, so he should be like, oh, I shouldn't be doing that, and start fearing sin and fearing punishment instead, since he didn't learn enough Torah yet. Is this a predetermined? Is this an order that if you have these types of fear and love in this order that he's saying, then you know you're doing it legit? And if you have, let's say, a certain type of love before you were supposed to have it, before you learn Torah, or you learn Torah and then you have one of those other ones and it's out of order, then it's not. Right?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I don't think it's so much. It could be it's prescriptive, that he's trying to tell you what you should do, but also it could be that it is actually descriptive.
That's
meaning
right.
That the question is, what exactly impelled a person to feel awe of Hashem? In other words, if we slice, if we did a cross-section, not a latitudinal cross-section, but a longitudinal cross-section, and see what happened in the process, we might be able to identify feelings of Yira, not necessarily Yira's onus in the sense that, you know, hell is hot, but rather fear of death, you know, questions about life, things like that, disturbing issues, which then led the person to look for something, and that so on and so forth goes on in that direction. It may be. I'm not sure, you know, how far he would take it. The possibility that that's what he's actually It could be, as I said, prescriptive or descriptive. Okay, let's go further. Let's do another piece. This one's actually associated. The next couple of them are associated. Techeles, although they each stand on their own. Techeles is Yiro. Techeles represents awe, or love. I mean, F here. Why is that?
Because
it's blue.
Right. Blue is like the heaven.
Blue is like the heaven.
Right.
So it's Yirat Shamayim, the fear of heaven. That's what blue represents. The love on Morech Chesed. The white indicates Chesed, V'ava, and love, Kayadua. You know, I never understood why, therefore, Techeles cost so much more money. The white has so much more of a beautiful symbolism, right? Versus Techeles, which costs so much more. You know, all those snails have to die for the Techeles. So I don't really have a good answer for that. I guess there must be some reason why Yira has to be more expensive than Ahava.
And time-consuming.
Right? I guess because money can't buy love. Isn't there some statement like that?
Yeah.
You can buy fear.
Yeah. So, Uri Sen, Uz Chasem Kol Mitzvot Hashem. It says you should see and you should remember all of Mitzvot of Hashem. Of course, he said that in Shema. Yira, you sow lo saseh. Yira is, in other words, when you look at the tzitzis with the tchelis, so yira is the yisod of which you see in the tchelis is the yisod of the lo saseh, is the basis of your remembering your fear or awe, which keeps you away from things which are forbidden, right? Whereas ava, love, is yisod la'aseh. That's fundamental for doing things for Hashem.
So, when we say in Shema that you should look at your tzitzis and remember all the mitzvahs, that both, you're supposed to look at both the white and the blue, when you look at the blue, you're supposed to remember fear of God, and when you look at the white, you're supposed to remember love of God.
Right. And
so today we should all have love of God like crazy because we have no blue.
Well, it happens to be that perhaps it's a mistake, but in most most processes of kiruv, and I'm not speaking just about place like Or Sameach, it's about when I teach in a place like Kushner, which is much more kiruv than Or Sameach. So then you re-emphasize today much more the love of Hashem. It's very hard to come to people and say, you've been there in the fires of hell. So I think there probably is some sort of emphasis nowadays on love over fear. Hmm. Whether that's linked to the fact that no chelus said, I can't tell you. So again, here is the fundamental. Lo sase and av is fundamental from mitzvah sase. Ubedikas hat chelus b'chamira. And it says the way you check chelus there's a whole process of checking it with detergent in order to make sure that it's val chelus. Because chelus is the dye so color fast that no detergent will take it out.
I mean, you can dunk it in bleach for 3 days and it's still there.
Yeah, I didn't try.
That's what they say on the website.
So I've never tried that one. Probably, yes.
Pretty strong.
So particularly, that was one of the complaints they had against the Raziner chelus. The chelus of the Raziner Rebbe, originally brought to the market in the 1800s, is that that chelus which came from the ink of a cuttlefish.
Or any other biological material.
it actually fades, could be rinsed, fades with detergent. It fades very quickly. So his chiddush was, which is, I think, one of his weaker arguments, that when it says it doesn't fade in detergent, it means in vinegar. Because he stuck it into vinegar, and the vinegar didn't fade. Okay? So the...
bleaches a little more.
The trellis sticks, and it doesn't come off. Well, it's custom enough. What does this represent? So the sort of shall you say, tokef hayetzer, by the strength of the Yetzer Hara is so powerful, or Shebe Ito. The Chazal likened the Yetzer Hara to the sourdough, which causes dough to ferment and rise. So since it's very strong and very powerful, lo yeh lo yifarei chazuso, mivnei omet Omekahira. It will not, it's not going to lose its countenance, the way it looks, because of the depth of the Yira. Aha! In other words, even the strength of the Yetzirah and the power of the Yetzirah will not be able to separate the, will not be able to cause the dye to run off the tzitzit, because Yira penetrates very, very deep. Because the idea of, I don't know exactly what it was chemically, but I assume color fast dye seeps very deeply into the molecular structure of the material, the materials to which they are, which they are dying. So it's so deeply embedded, the Yira is so powerfully embedded, that powerfully embedded Yira prevents and repels the Yetzirah, which attempts to take it away, to remove it. That's what he says, that's why Kalos is so color fast, and even whatever you do to it, it's still not going to go away. It's also, the message is also the flip side, that if you, the Kalos does go away, if Yira is only, is able, is, if your Yira is such that it can be removed by the attack of these breaches, so that it wasn't authentic Yira to begin with. Of course, we have an axiom that every Jew has somewhere at their core at least a smidgen, some amount of Yira, which no Jew ever completely loses. But, obviously, it's talking about the relative levels of Yira, and some people have more, some people have less. So an authentic Yira is one which is able to withstand all sorts of temptations. Not that you're not going to sin necessarily, sometimes you slip up, you mess up, but that it's still there and a person carries it whenever, wherever you go. So here it's interesting. He says, the Tzaddik actually explains why we don't have Tcheles nowadays. He says, Yira Chazoka Kol Kach Ein Lanu Achshav. Since we don't have such great Yira in our day and age, none of us are such great Yirei Hashem and Yirei Chet like they had in the old days. So therefore, we Arachosim love on. We only have white. We don't have Tcheles anymore, because our fear of Hashem is not perfect, is not complete. Arachosim love on Kayadua. So he says an interesting thing. As is known, Shemei Rachok, from a distance, because when we're in Golos, we're at a distance from Hashem. Shemei Rachok, Ha'ava Kala Yosem Min Ha'ira. When you're at a distance, love is easier than fear or awe. In other words, like absence makes the heart, makes the heart grow fonder. There's a kind of love can traverse great distances. But it's very hard to be in awe of something which you don't perceive directly. In other words, you're in awe of something when you're in its presence. When you're not in the presence of something, even if you can depict it, you know, imagine it, think about it, it's still not the same thing as being in the direct presence. So at the time when the bond between Am Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was very strong, so and there was a presence, a Shekhinah, so then there was Yira, and then there was Chelet. But now that we're at a great distance, we have a much easier time with love. Because again, love is easier than Yira, and he says, Kimei Rachok, Hashem Nirol Lanu Yoyser Binyan Avod Vekus. Because from a distance, we can perceive Hashem more in the manner of love and of connection.
So, when we have so with love, we can see, like, in front of our faces all the stuff Hashem gives us because we're alive. Every time we're alive, and every breath we take, we can be like, ah, Hashem loves me because I'm breathing. He's not killing me now. But, and then whenever we see something bad happen in the world, we always attribute it to the world. Usually, the first reaction of people today, and not to God. It's not like, oh, God did it. We never say that. I don't know why. We always say that, like, you know, when something bad happens, everyone always says, oh, well, we don't want, like, we never say, oh, God did it. We never say God is a vengeful God, and he drew his wrath upon this person or something like that.
That's interesting. Once, many years ago, I think it was in the late 80s, maybe it was the early 80s, there was a Sephardi rabbi who was a member of the Knesset who said once that there was a big fight in Petach Tikva about movie theaters being open on Shabbos. And there were months and months of demonstrations and you know, sit-ins, the religious community fighting with the secular community. And it came to pass that one day a busload of kids from Petah Tikva was in an accident with a train, and 20-some-odd kids were killed. And this fellow, this is a Sephardi rabbi, his name is Rabbi Peretz, he said that, who knows, maybe it's because the movie theaters are open in Petah Tikva on Shabbos that 20-some-odd kids from Petah Tikva were killed. And that created a tremendous, tremendous scandal at the time. And, you know, I thought, you know, that's really what you're supposed to do. The Rambam says, if something goes wrong, you're supposed to try and find a cause why things go wrong. So if a person doesn't try and find a cause for things to go wrong, then he's missing the whole boat. He's not approaching the affliction the right way. So, but it seems, some people get annoyed, people get disturbed with this, because I guess because of what you're saying. Basically.
It's like, if people did attribute bad things to God, then we would have almost the same level a year. Like, if people's first reaction when something went bad was, God did it, let's fix ourselves, you know, that it was God who did it directly from God that killed this person or that, you know, that made this tree fall on the building, then people would have, I think, as much year as anyone as well. But now we seem to only want, especially the Reform and the Conservative, they only attribute God to good things, never to bad things. They always say, oh, God does so much nice things, but they never say God does bad things, like never does bad things. It's like very one-sided. So I think that might be like why we don't have a sense of Yirah, because it's not, like you said, it's distance from us. Like to have Yirah of Hashem, we don't really have fear of punishment as much because that's not in front of us, because anytime something that bad happens, we blame nature or something, mm-hmm. Not God. And then the only fear that we can have is awe, because that's just depending on knowledge of God, but that's a very high level, so not many people like are really close to that level. But love, we can see all around us all the time, and, like, you know, things that are, you know, good. Like, we have food today, or something like that.
But to add on to that, Rabbi Saul Salanter, in the Mishnah system, stressed to a great extent Yiras Onish, fear of punishment. And everybody was bothered by that, because we know that Yiras Onish, fear of punishment, is a lower form of Yira. The higher form of Yira is Yiras Haromimus, the awe. So Rabbi Avraham Aryeh Kaplan, he says, explains the reason why Rabbi Saul pushed Yiras Onish is because that's facing reality as it is. Meaning that you have to know that there are, you know, there are flip sides, there are downsides of the world. Not everything is pink and rosy. So then these things can happen if you don't fix what you're supposed to fix. So then things, Rahman al-Islam, can happen. But yeah, as you say, yeah, it's not, certainly if you go to, seminars and speeches, that's not something that they should have. At least not that I've heard in recent times.
Yeah, I've talked to people who get really annoyed at the, you know, like when the tsunami hit that country or whatever, you know, people got really annoyed if anyone said, oh, well, there must be some reason why God did that. It's like, they don't like to think like that for some reason. Like, they, you know, and we know that God controls everything in the world at all times, so he's creating the world over and over again, every millisecond. He has control over every little piece of everything. So when something like that happens, it's because of God's will. So, like, but we never attribute it to God. You know, it's just like, don't talk about it and don't think about it and then just, like, keep going. I never understood quite why.
Yeah, one of the reasons is because people don't know exactly, even when they try, they always stumble over what to say about that. For example,
right.
For the tsunami, there are many Rabbanim who said that it was sent by God for the purpose of getting Klal Yisrael to do tshuva. But that's really, it doesn't follow.
Yeah,
it's really kind of, if you want Klal Yisrael to do tshuva, you should do something to Klal Yisrael. Why do 150,000...
Really.
What? Yeah, okay, but there were a few, right? But why do 150,000 Asians have to be killed, the dark? In my theology, it doesn't seem to work. At least I don't understand how that works.
Well, I'm not saying so much attribute reason to it, like God did this, God made this car crash because he wants Joe Schmo to, you know, be nicer to his wife. I mean, like, instead of saying, oh, that was a terrible accident, happenstance, you say, no, God caused that car crash, and we're not sure why, but, you know, we should realize that it's all from God, and not Because I think there's like, I think there's a disconnect in like a lot of people.
It's
on an intellectual level. On an emotional level, I probably agree with everybody not to talk like that. But like on an intellectual level, you really like from gut.
I actually had many years ago when I was in Shalvim, I had a Rebbe who was able. I have a picture of him in my study. You can come and look at his picture. It's a frightening picture. So his talk, especially before Hashem Yom Kippur, you actually felt he was able to convey a sense of dread, a sense of impending doom, which is good for that time of year, right? And he was able to do it. He was able to bring about, and it's very rare. I mean, since then, I have never experienced it. So, and I think, I don't know why exactly, but I think Yiddish and Hebrew lend themselves more to that kind of atmosphere setting than English does. Because in Hebrew and Yiddish, I've heard such talks. In English, I don't think I've ever heard such a talk.
Because most English listeners don't like that type of thing.
Right, so. Although I think the old Protestant ministers in the old days, they had fire and brimstone speeches, that's what they say.
That's what the religion is based on.
When I was learning some of the Tanya, it was talking about like in that time it talks about like fear of Hashem being like fear of the king, you know, like how we can relate to it today, fear of the king is that. We were talking about how it's for us learning it today, it's very hard because we don't even know what fear of a king means. Like fear of a king a couple hundred years ago really meant that a king could just bring you in and like have you killed for if he doesn't like you, you know, he can be killed. And it's like a whole different level because today we don't even have that same kind of fear. We don't have that fear for anyone. We don't have that fear for the president. We don't have that fear for the government.
Bush is coming back.
It doesn't exist today.
I think we should get Bush the power just like, thanks, go.
It's interesting. The Lubavitchers did have that for the Rebbe. That type of dread. Like one time, the last time I was at Crown Heights, when the Rebbe was alive and functioning, which was sometime in the early 80s, late mid-80s, so I was standing, I was standing with everybody else, and everybody was standing in a line, two lines outside 770, waiting for the Rebbe to come out. So they were lining the path and sidewalk, coming from the walkway from the door from 770 out into the street. I was standing there with my cousin there on the side, and when the Rebbe came out, everybody ran back, you know, as if in tremendous dread. Even though they were standing lined the path before, they all ran backwards, and I'm embarrassed to say that I ran together with them. And there were some bold people who were desperate for bracha who walked forward. What? No. There were some people who were able to stand there. The ones who were particularly desperate for bracha, they stood their ground. But you see from that I had actually that type of dread, that type of fear from the Rebbe. I don't know if the Rebbe was the Rebbe, because the Rebbe's an old man. I don't know exactly, but there was that type of experience there. So there are times, but it's very rare, very, very, very hard to find nowadays.
I was trying to show up in Canada. They had the Yom Kippur Drusha. They would go through rabbis a lot, and if the rabbi was too lenient, they said, "I wasn't Yom Kippur Drusha. What was that? That was nothing. You know, you need to tear into us." And so they'd fire him. They'd get a new rabbi, and he would be too strict, and he would like try to put all the dread into them. They'd say, "You don't like him, taught us over that bad. Fire him." Next guy. So the rabbi had to be very careful not to be too much or too little.
I think it would be hard to put a sense of dread on people who don't believe in God. The generations when they did believe in God, like Amaratim, but they were driven to do mitzvahs, so they would kill them with the fire of hell, so people would start to do mitzvahs. But now people don't believe in God at all, so that's why they try to make the speech pleasant, like, God love you, you should do mitzvahs. It's a God's love, you know? So why should we believe in that God?
So what you're saying basically is that since there's a lack of emuna, so therefore there's a lack of yira, which is probably true, because the way you get Yira is by Shivisi Hashem and Negdi Tomi, because you envision yourself always before God. But if your Muna is not strong, even if you do believe in God, but if your Muna is not a powerful, strong presence in your life, then yes, then how are you going to have Yira? That's like Rav Tzadok said, then love becomes much more effective.
It's like the Sfaris, like old school Sfaris, like 50 years ago. They didn't keep semi mitzvahs, but they would have such a munah because they were in the middle of the Arab country. So there's the munah of God is just the way of the land. They had such a munah that when their rabbi would yell at them about something, they would just do it. Like you know, they were like freaked out. They would just do anything he said.
Okay, we'll stop here for this evening. You can keep the sheets. You can get back.